Hello once again, and welcome to another Storytelling Field episode of Musings on Golf. I am Kelly Elbin. My co-host Bob Bupka is taking the week off. Boy, do we ever have plenty to talk about, highlighted by our special guest today, Dean Beaman, the commissioner of the PGA Tour for 20 incredible years, one of the most influential figures in the history of golf is Mr. Beaman. We'll also revisit yet another winning performance by Scottie Scheffler, who won for the third time in his last four outings, this time at Jack's Place, the Memorial Tournament in Ohio. We'll take a quick look back at golf's longest day as the last 47 spots were secured on Monday and then Tuesday morning for the U.S. Open through the 36-hole qualifying. I want to start with a trip that I took recently. It was over in the U.K. for 13 days with seven other golf junkies, and we played 10 magnificent golf courses, including five that are on the Open Championship Rota. We did this through Hidden Links, a company that specializes in these kinds of tours. It was great. A fair amount of driving. I mean, we covered the entire country of England and most of Scotland in a large van. We had a great driver who knew the game inside and out. But to be able to play Royal St. George's and Royal Lytham and St. Anne's, Royal Birkdale, and then go into Scotland and play Royal Troon and Carnoustie, again, all of which are part of the Open Rota. As a matter of fact, Royal Troon is where Xander Schauffele won the Open Championship last year. And also to play Turnberry, which is really recognized more than anything else as where Tom Watson outlasted Jack Nicklaus in what became the Duel in the Sun. But we closed out our really incredible trip. We played 10 rounds in 11 days, which is a lot of golf when you're walking. But man, was it worth it. We closed it out at Prestwick Golf Club, where the very first Open Championship was played in 1860. And you know, a few takeaways, you recognize how much, oh my goodness, how, particularly in Scotland, how much golf is a fabric of the towns, of the people, of the communities, of the country. I mean, there are golf courses sprinkled throughout. I remember playing at Carnoustie and putting out on the last green. I looked over and there were three little kids at an adjacent golf course, five, six, seven-year-olds putting. It's what they do there. And there are so many opportunities to play there. Carry your own bag. You don't see any buggies, any golf carts over there. People with trolleys, little, they, you know, put the golf carts on a trolley and push them around. It's what golf originally was. The natural environments, the big bunkers. Boy, stay out of those bunkers, but they're in the fairways, but it's hard not to. But you know, the passion for the game and the history of the game. A little bit different this year, by the way, because the Open Championship will not be played in either Scotland or England. It returns to Royal Portrush in Northern Ireland, where Ireland's Shane Lowry won in 2019. So just a fabulous trip, and looking forward actually to, at some point, I'd love to be able to get to Ireland and play there. The many great golf courses in Northern Ireland and also in the Republic of Ireland. We're going to talk more with and hear from both Scottie Scheffler and Jack Nicklaus on the other side of the interview with Dean Beaman. Also want to mention about the golf's longest day on the other side as well. But Dean Beaman, you know, before he became the commissioner of the PGA Tour in 1974, he was an outstanding player. Dean Beaman won four times on the PGA Tour. He won the U.S. Amateur twice, won the British Amateur. Great putter. And just coincidentally, I was lucky enough to grow up playing my junior golf at Bethesda Country Club outside of Washington, D.C., where Dean Beaman was legendary. His family belonged there. He set all kinds of records there. It's interesting. You'll hear when I ask him who would be the three people he would play a sort of a dream round of golf with. He goes back to the gentleman who was the head professional at his time in Bethesda. There's a reason why Dean Beaman was elected to the World Golf Hall of Fame. It essentially created the TPC courses with the TPC Sawgrass and the Island Green we know on 17 is kind of the center of it all. He created the Senior PGA Tour, now known as the PGA Tour Champions. He took a an organization that was given about $1 million a year to charities when he started. And by 20 years later, they were giving $30 million a year to charities. And he grew the tour itself from revenues of about $400,000 in 1974 to more than $260 million when he retired and Tim Finchem took over in 1994. So the influence of Dean Beaman, and you'll find out as well why he left, why he didn't continue playing, why he chose to become the second PGA Tour commissioner. A gentleman named Joe Dye, longtime executive with the United States Golf Association, was the first PGA Tour commissioner. And then Mr. Beaman took over and truly changed golf as we know it at the elite level. And Dean certainly has a lot to say about LIV Golf and a lot of topics. And he's still playing golf himself. He loves the game, passion for the game. When he retired from as commissioner, he played a fair amount on the senior tour. Great interview. You're really going to enjoy it. So very lucky to be able to talk to Dean Beaman. And you will hear from the commish right after these messages from our terrific partners, William & Harry and Titleist. William & Harry has entered a bold new era, led by their new Lionhead logo, a symbol of strength, leadership, and fearless ambition. Step onto the course with purpose. Outplay the field and dominate your opponent while wearing handcrafted shoes that blend performance, luxury, and unmistakable style. William & Harry offers custom designs featuring your club, company, or organization's logo so you stand out with every step. Visit williamandharry.com and use code 15OFFMOG for 15% off. William & Harry, walk with the lion.
Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X are the best performing, most consistent in the game. So how does the best get better? You start by listening to the best players in the world. You experiment, iterate, validate. You trust the best process to create the best golf ball the game has ever known. The all-new Pro V1 and Pro V1X. More speed off the tee, more control with your irons, more spin with your wedges, and more opportunity to shoot your lowest scores.
Well, the incredible success story that is the PGA Tour can be traced back to the vision of our special guest today. Over two decades as the Tour's commissioner, he introduced the concept of stadium golf, developed a network of TPC courses nationwide, delivered to charities and to his players enormous growth in dollars in terms of benefiting those charities and growing the purses to what became a multi-billion dollar business, a member of the World Golf Hall of Fame. He's with us today. We're going to cover a lot of ground. Mr. Dean Beaman, welcome to Musings on Golf. How are you?
I'm delighted to be here with you today. I'm good. Good as you can be at my age. I keep working at it every day. So I'm delighted to be with you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And I understand you're playing as much as you can. How often do you play golf and where do you play most of your golf?
Well, I play, I try to play two or three times a week, but I actually practice almost every day. Not very many days go by that I don't go out and at least hit some golf balls.
And that's that you live in Ponte Vedra Beach and you've lived there since your days on tour, working for the tour, right?
Yes, I have for, since 1979. And I live pretty close to Pablo Creek Golf Club. And that's where I play most of my golf.
Hey, Dean, as I said at the start, we're going to cover a lot of ground. I'd like to start with the modern world of golf. I'm wondering, there's been so much activity this year in the PGA Tour and LIV Golf trying somehow, some way to find common ground. I want to get your thoughts on whether you think there will be some kind of resolution, if you will, between the Tour and LIV Golf, and whether you think that might happen anytime soon, Dean.
I don't have any inside information on where they are. I think the last release I saw on it, the Saudis made a specific offer, which was rejected by the tour. And I think I think they can reach an agreement if the Saudis want to invest in golf and invest in the future of golf. Mm-hmm. But if they want to buy some kind of control into the game of golf, and particularly the PGA Tour, I just don't think they can make a deal.
Yeah, and I'm wondering also, I've read, as you have, their desire, PIF's desire to have the team concept play a big role. Can the tour ever sign off on that, where you'd have a regular team events? I mean, you see that with the Zurich Invitational. You see a one-time event on the PGA Tour, but team golf, does the tour want that?
It's really actually not a question whether the tour wants that. It's a question whether the public wants that. We have a couple of things that you could call team golf, which are the President's Cup and the Ryder Cup, and of course for amateur golf, the Walker Cup. But the public hasn't shown to me that they're looking for anything beyond those kinds of very special events in some sort of team concept. Golf is an individual game. It's not a team game, although it does come together once or twice a year in some very special team event like the Ryder Cup or the President's Cup, and that's very popular. But I haven't seen any indication that any other form of team golf that would be successful.
I'm interested when the Saudis kind of burst on the scene, if you will, Dean, and made it known with Greg Norman involved, et cetera, that they were going to make a major play, and in fact did, poaching a good number of named players away from the PGA Tour. Strictly in hindsight, do you think if you had been commissioner at that time, you likely would have handled things differently than Jay Monahan did at the time?
I think with a problem like the tour faced, and a very complicated situation with an organization like the Saudis that have virtually unlimited resources. Yeah. And you're dealing with an organization like the PGA Tour that has a number of constituencies that are very important to the game. That, you know, they're concerned about the game of golf itself. They work for the players and for the benefit of the players, but also have the constituencies of the local tournament sponsors and the volunteers and the charities. And, I don't think the Saudis are interested in the charities, and I'm not sure that they care much about the volunteers. But the PGA Tour has raised more money for charity than all other sports combined. And what the last 3 years with LIV, that they have not been able to build a product that is viable. Now they may continue to be involved, but at a huge loss of a couple billion dollars a year, and I'm not sure they'll continue to do that. But the PGA Tour is interested in the game of golf itself. clearly very interested in its players, but also have a great responsibility to the communities that put on our events and the volunteers that are essential to running any golf tournament and the local charities that benefit.
Yeah, and there's no question that the PGA Tour was in a tough spot in the decisions that were made. I'm wondering, even to today, Dean, where you have signature events, clearly the 72 player events, like you saw at Philadelphia Cricket Club with the Truist, there certainly seems to me they're designed to make sure that the top players are taken care of, that they stay with the PGA Tour. Is that a sustainable product, Dean? Is that good for the PGA Tour to have a series of these, quote, signature events that frankly really benefit a relatively minor amount of players on tour?
Well, I think the realities are that in order for the tour to not allow someone with just a pocket full of money to steal away the top players and the best known players that the tour has spent years to develop, I'm not sure that any other approach than the one that has been taken is viable. Well, as long as, in my opinion, I think this is shared by the tour executives. As long as there is an opportunity for the players that are not in that select few to get in those special events, mm-hmm. as long as it shows that there's an opportunity, if you play at a high level, you can get in. I don't think there's any problem with it. Okay. I go back to a long time ago. When I turned professional and went on the PGA Tour, I went to qualifying school down at the PGA National. I finished second in qualifying school, and it earned me a place to be a member of the PGA Tour. But at the same time, the only thing I got was the ability to go to Monday qualifying. And I had to show superior playing ability to get beyond that Monday qualifying. Now, what is happening today is a hell of a lot easier than that. Believe me, that was difficult because I think when I turned professional, there were only 50 exempt places. It turned to 60 exempt places in the first year or so that I became a professional. But there were only 60 exempt places. Everybody else, either if you didn't make the cut and you couldn't get in the next tournament unless you went to Monday qualifying. So the system today is a lot fairer. And when I became commissioner, having experienced those early days, and I developed the what is now the Korn Ferry Tour to provide an opportunity for players to earn their spot. We went to the all exempt tour that made more people exempt throughout the year, and now of course we have the senior tour. Because we had a lot of lifetime exempt players that really were not competitive, and we made a spot for them with the senior tour. So we developed all of those things to increase the opportunities for competition. And I don't think that has been diminished today at all. I think if a player, as you can see, in the last few years, an awful lot of young players have come up and And so the system, sure, we can figure out what little different changes you'd make if it were you, but the system is pretty daggone good as I look at it. And the opportunity for new players coming on, certainly playing at a high level, is not an impediment to their success.
Yeah, you make a very good point. The Cognizant Classic in the Palm Beach is the old Honda Classic here. Where I live in Palm Beach Gardens, Joe Highsmith won the event this year against a pretty good field. Not a great field, but a pretty good field. Joe Highsmith, to me, Dean, is representative of exactly what you're saying. A guy with a lot of talent, given the opportunity, he can not only play with the big boys, but he can beat them.
Yeah, that's right. So you might and I might tweak it this way and that, but the basic system is pretty sound, and has shown a great benefit to the players wanting to compete. Young players coming up through college, and it's provided that opportunity. It's not a free ride, and golf was never professional golf was never. At the competitive level, designed to be a free ride, but if you are, if you can excel, it can be a great benefit to you. But it's not a free ride.
Well, we are off and running with the great Dean Beaman, the second commissioner of the PGA Tour. And Dean, I note that because Joe Dye, the great executive for so many years with the United States Golf Association, was actually first commissioner of what became known as the PGA Tour when the tour broke away from the PGA of America. You won four times on the PGA Tour. You won the U.S. Amateur twice. What made you ultimately pursue that job that landed you as the commissioner of the PGA Tour and to essentially say, I'm done as a player competitively?
Well, I didn't. That's not the way it happened. I didn't seek the job at all. Okay. I was on the PGA Tour Policy Board at the time when Joe Dye was commissioner. And I had just had some surgery the fall before and was just starting to get back into some sort of reasonable playing form. This was in May of 1973, and we were headed for a policy board meeting in Memphis, Tennessee, and Joe Dye and the then chairman of the board, who was Paul Austin of Coca-Cola Company, asked me to ride to the golf course where we were holding the policy board meeting. And on that trip, what they did was and they told me that Joe Dye had decided to retire when his contract was up then in the spring of 1974, and that they had decided that they wanted to ask me to become commissioner. And this was right out of the blue. And I thought about it, and Paul Austin told me to just think about it. Don't respond. Think about it a little while. And so the following week, I called Paul Austin and basically told him that I had never pursued anything in my life that I was failing and when I quit. And at that time, my game had not come back around since the surgery. I was not inclined to be able to leave the competition and become commissioner. So I told them no, is what I told them. And so they put a committee together to seek for the new commissioner. And so I can't continue to play that summer. And late in the summer, I won my fourth tournament. went from that that event in St. Louis. I went to California to play in. I'm trying to think of the event that we played, but that doesn't make any difference. But the following week, after I'd won, now I have a 2-year exemption. I'm in the Masters and the Open and all of the events. I thought about where I was. I turned professional very late. I was 30 years old before I turned professional. I'd had a number of surgeries and setbacks and I took a really good look at myself and decided I might be able to do more for the game of golf as commissioner than as a player. So I called Paul Austin the week after I won and told him, I'm sure you saw I won tournament last week. I feel fully exempt for the next couple of years for all the events. So I can walk away now feeling good about myself. And if you still want me to be commissioner, put my name in a ring. And that's how it happened.
Well, first of all, thank you for setting me straight on that important historical information. It came out of the blue. But Dean, what you ultimately built with the TPC courses and with the Players Championship and with the Senior Tour, how in the world did you begin to frame a business model that began to put together these parts of golf that we're all so familiar with? None of those existed before you. How does the Dean Beaman, your brain work to get started as the commissioner and to do it on such a large level?
Well, I'm not sure we have enough time to go into all of that,
I think you're right.
The biggest problem we faced at the time was bowling had more events on television and got more television revenue than golf. I had to figure out why it was that golf was so difficult to get any reasonable rights fee from the networks. And it didn't take very long to figure it out the television networks could televise a football game, a basketball game, hockey, with one or two cameras and one or two people in the stadium. They could walk in, and it probably at that time didn't cost more than $25,000 or $30,000 to put on an event. And to do a golf tournament, they had to string cables out. They had to bring trailers in with equipment. It cost $250,000 to do a golf tournament and $25,000 to do a football game. Well, hello.
Exactly.
And we were getting a pittance for under $100,000 per event. The only reason that we got on most of our televised events were our celebrities, Bob Hope and Andy Williams and Dean Martin.
And Jackie.
Yeah. So they had contracts with networks and we got on television through them, not through the value of the product and the arithmetic that they needed to look at on. And not only that, golf is a high profile but low rated on television. So our television ratings were much lower than a broader perspective like football and basketball has. So those were the problems that we're facing. And we figured out the way to do that was to create a product through commercialization of the event. to bring in corporate sponsors and to have them put up the dollars for television, put up the dollars to help the local community with the purses. And that's the model that was built. So the PGA Tour is built around our title and commercial sponsors.
Right.
And the interesting part about it is that when we wanted to do that, the television networks then had a policy against commercialization. They would not allow the camera or the announcer to talk about anything commercial except it during a commercial break. So we had to change the policy of the television networks, and we convinced both CBS and NBC that that was that they should do that and allow that, and ABC would not allow that. So our and most of our events were with ABC. So we started the program of developing title sponsors of our events through a contract with CBS and NBC. And as a result of that, everybody won. Everybody won. And one of the things that is interesting is that the amount that we charged to a corporate sponsor, it wasn't, he didn't get his value just on the telecast. He got his value because the event during the tournament week was covered in every newspaper and every local telecast, and they no longer called it the Hartford Open. They called it Travelers. Okay. Yes. And when they called it Travelers, they were getting on a sports program with the Traveler's name where they couldn't even buy an ad. And the same thing in the local newspapers all around the country. And when you add up the value of the local telecast and the local papers and with the Traveler's name on the sports page and in the broadcast of the local sports broadcast, the value that they were getting were three times what they were paying us.
So the investment for them.
More and more commercial sponsors came to realize that if they go on television for a sport and they put up $2 million, they get $2 million worth of advertising. But if it became a title sponsor, they may get $8 million worth of value for $2 million investment. And that's how golf works.
And Dean, you mentioned that earlier on that terrific explanation about everybody won. Please talk about the charitable component and what was introduced to really benefit charities at tremendous benefit to them through tour events week after week after week.
That's interesting in of itself. There was always some charitable investment and charitable endeavor in some events, but back then a lot of our events were run by organizations that really got most of the money. They're promoters.
Yeah.
And, my objective was to make sure that the PGA professionals playing on the tour got a reasonable amount of money for what they did compared to other sports. So, in developing the concept of commercial sponsors and raising prize money and knowing that the volunteers were completely essential to run a golf tournament, I figured that it would be over a period of time, if we were really successful, that as prize monies rose, I didn't think the volunteers would be really happy if they put up $1 million or $2 million and basically the players came into town and played for it and took it all out of town. Yep. So I proposed to the policy board and they agreed that we wouldn't cancel any events or cancel any contracts, but in the future, any new events or any events that we contracted for in the future, 100% of the net proceeds of that event had to go to charity. That would be recognition of the contribution of the volunteers make that are essential to running golf tournaments. And that's where we are over a period of time. I think all of the events today, both the Senior Tour and the Korn Ferry Tour and the PGA Tour, all of them are 100% of the net proceeds go to charity.
So pleased to be joined by the great Dean Beaman here on Musings on Golf. Dean, everybody, anybody who's a golf fan knows of the 17th hole, the most famous par three now in the world at TPC Sawgrass. Not sure everybody knows that Alice Dye was really the mastermind behind the design of that hole. But Dean, would you talk just a little about how the relationship with Pete Dye came to be, that Pete was chosen along with Alice to design what has become one of the great golf courses in the world at TPC Sawgrass?
Well, let me start. I don't want to run you out of time here, but let me start by the concept of the event anyway. When the Players Championship started, it started in Atlanta and then moved to Fort Worth. It was designed originally by Joe Dye to move around the country like the U.S. Open does. And, you know, and unless you want to put your event in the best dates available. And as a result of that, you have to take that spot away from somebody who's been a sponsor for you for years. Yeah. That didn't make sense to me. Maybe we were going to be the winner, but the local community had been running a tournament for us is going to be a loser year after year as we move it around. So I decided that the best way to do it was to try to find a tournament sponsor who already existed that was willing to cooperate with us and become a partner in our event. And I started looking for that. And I came up with Jacksonville because they were probably at the low end of the events on the winter circuit. And so we could both benefit. So we put that together. Once we started that and I didn't want to move it around. It's very expensive to move it around. I wanted it in one place so that we continue to build that event. And of course, Jacksonville became that spot. Then I decided that we needed to, for us to continue to build the event, we were going to have to invest a lot of money in the facility itself to benefit the players and the community and the spectators. And so I decided that it would be best if we owned the event and owned the place so that we could invest in our own property. And we tried to buy Sawgrass. That was not possible. They wouldn't sell it to us. So I decided to build our own place. And that came as a result of back in the early 60s with Eddie, if you remember Eddie Ault, where you grew sure. up.
Yes, sir.
He and I went into partnership in a golf event or a golf course that was actually never built. But while we were planning that, we got to talking about where tournaments were held. And the concept through Eddie Ault and myself of stadium golf, yeah. of building golf courses specifically for tournaments that had the uh, the areas that would accommodate spectators that they could really see the golf was a concept that we got interested in. This was back in 1960.
Wow.
61. So we went to Joe Dye, actually. We went to the USGA and proposed to the USGA that they build half a dozen golf courses around the country where that would hold their major championships. And at the same time, they were developing their agronomy program that they could use for agronomy experimentation.
That makes sense.
And it took us about 15 minutes with Joe Dye, and he thought it was a brilliant idea that he wasn't interested in. So it went away for years.
Yeah. Great idea, great idea, but Mr. Dye had no desire to pursue it, right?
That's right. So when I had the challenge of building the Players' Championship into what it is today, I took that concept of stadium golf that Eddie Alt and I had talked through and actually did some drawings and everything else. It was quite interesting. And decided to build a stadium golf course. Now, Pete Dye, I as a player, I was I got an opportunity to play Harbortown, and I felt Harbortown was one of the best golf courses, the greatest balance for talent, right and left versus left and right, and I hired Pete Dye because of Harbortown, because of what he had done at Harbortown. And I wanted him to do the same thing. I wanted a golf course that didn't favor a long hitter or a short hitter, and that didn't favor a left to a right. It had variety. And so Pete Dye was on my top of my list, and he got interested in it and agreed to come and design our golf course.
And what an incredibly creative mind Mr. Dye had. And it is true, Dean Beeman, that Alice, she was the designer of the 17th hole. Is that correct?
Well, not quite. Not quite. What happened was that we have, you know, when we started on that piece of property, there wasn't a hill on the golf course more than a foot high. And it was a place that between A1A and the Intercoastal Waterway, that when those were built, it kept the water in that area, so it became a swamp. And when we went in there and started building, there was muck of at least 2 or 3 feet deep everywhere. And as we started building the golf course and moving that muck into the spectator areas, we were trying to find sand to build our fairways and tees and greens. And the place where the best sand was 17. And as we needed more and more sand, we got a bigger and bigger lake for this par three. And when we ended up with all the sand we needed, we ended up with a huge place with just a small place for the green. And there was a big discussion about whether we ought to have a couple of bunkers around, whether we ought to have a place where the ball would run off. And Alice Dye clearly was influential in saying, no, let's just make it an island, just a straight island. So, yeah, she did have a role in it, but it was a role after the fact. It wasn't designed that way, but her influence on Pete to make it a stadium. Now, the other part of that was Pete wanted about 165-yard hole on that. And I stood up and said, no way in the world are we going to have an island green that long. So yes. I exerted my influence to make sure that it was not any longer than about 135 yards.
A wise decision indeed. And we just had a few more questions for Dean Beeman here on Musings on Golf. Dean, this has been terrific. I do not in any way want to minimize how good of a player you were. And I'm wondering, what do you remember in 1969 U.S. Open, Sarge Moody, Orville Moody ended up winning that U.S. Open, but you tied for second at the 69 U.S. Open. What do you remember from those days?
I remember pretty clearly. I know that the rules of golf were different back then, and on the 10th hole, I'd hit a pretty good shot in there, and my ball made a divot, and my line of putt was right behind my divot, but I couldn't repair the divot on the green back then. And I remember having a pretty short putt for birdie and no chance over the divot. And then I remember coming to 18 and making birdie on the last hole, and Orville Moody was playing behind me. And so I made a birdie on the last hole, and I tied, I'm trying to think of the other player that was tied with me, maybe Rosberg. But anyway, Orville Moody came to the last hole, and Orville Moody was maybe the worst putter in the world of all time. And there was not anybody around 18 that thought he would be able to make his last putt, including Orville.
But including him, right, yeah.
So I lost by a shot, did bury the last hole, knowing that I had a chance to win if I buried the last hole. But that's my recollection of it.
You tied for second with Al Geiberger and Bob Rosberg at Champions. What a great golf club that is in Houston.
Yes, it is. Jimmy DeMeritt and Jackie Burke built a great facility there. They had a number of championships played there, and a great facility and a great two great tour players.
Dean, two more questions. One current and one kind of sentimental, if you will. USGA is going to roll back the golf ball. It's going to happen for recreational players. It's going to happen for elite players. I'm wondering your thoughts on that, particularly as it relates to the PGA Tour.
Well, I've got a lot of thoughts on that. I don't know if you have enough time left for that.
Fire away.
Number one is that I don't agree with what the USGA is trying to do. I think that when I finished second in the U.S. Open down in Houston, mm-hmm. The golf course was, I believe, 6,900 yards long. And that was long for a golf course.
Yeah.
I don't think there are many courses in the country that are less than 71 or 7,200 today.
Correct.
So, if you cut the distance of off a drive, on the PGA Tour, a player, that is a modest hitter is going to be relegated to going back home. If you can hit it 330 now and you're only going to hit it 310.
Yeah.
Okay. But what happens if you're only hit it 290 and you're only going to hit it 260? Yeah. The answer is that you're not going to get home in par fives, and on long par fours, you're going to be hitting woods into it instead of iron. And so unless you're a buster, the answer is you're going to not be able to compete. So now, as far as the average player is concerned, he doesn't hit it long enough anyway to play the golf courses he's playing. I have always thought that if you return the golf ball to where it was in the late 60s and early 70s with more spin and with the dimpling not designed in a wind tunnel, okay, so that if you mishit it, it did spin and therefore did curve, that the guy that was big and strong and could swing that fast, if he didn't hit it perfectly, he may not be able to find it. It wouldn't be just going in the rough a little bit. It would, if it's starting to curve, if you watch television every day and you see what happened to a golf ball, it starts to curve and then it stops curving.
Yeah.
Okay. Because it doesn't have enough spin to continue to curve. So if they change that, and the other part of that is the average player doesn't swing hard enough and doesn't have enough club head speed to put enough spin on a ball to keep it in the air. So a ball that spun more would help the average player and hurt the guy that swung at the highest speeds but didn't hit it perfectly.
Well, Dean, I appreciate those responses. I've looked at it, and maybe my thoughts are too naive, but I've just never understood the thinking of, for the recreational amateur player at this stage of the advancements in the game, why in the world would you ever want to put something in play that makes the game maybe less enjoyable, that you don't hit the ball as far? I just simply don't understand why you'd want to do that for the well-being of the game at large.
Not only that, I think you're correct, but not only that, you don't have to do that in order to rein in. But believe me, if Rory McIlroy, who is our longest hitter today, yeah, at the very top, no question about that, if he were confronted with when he mishit it, that he didn't miss it by 15 yards, he missed it by 40 yards. The answer is he may have to rein it in. Okay, he may have to rein it in. But I don't, I believe that the current golf balls, all of them, are not good for the average player, because they don't spin enough for the ball to stay in the air enough. And so they use a softer golf ball that they can launch more, but it still doesn't spin, so they don't have enough spin to hold the ball on the green. So, today's technology helps the tour player, the big hitting tour player, and hurts the average player.
Hey, Dean, two final questions. In your opinion, who's the greater player between Jack and Tiger, and why?
I'm not sure anybody can. I don't think anybody can. They may say who's their favorite player, but who's the best? It's pretty tight.
Would you give a nod to either guy?
Not at this point. We're going to take a look and see what happens with Tiger in the next couple of years.
Very good. Final question. This is one that I ask of all of our guests, Dean. If you could have a dream foursome, so to speak, of three other individuals, whether they're still with us or the deceased, who would round out your dream foursome, and where would you play that kind of magical round of golf?
Oh, I'd probably go back to Bethesda Country Club and play with my son and Harry Grismer and the assistant professional there that gave me my first lessons.
So Mr. Beeman and I were very lucky, folks, to have grown up playing our junior golf at Bethesda Country Club outside of Washington, D.C. And Dean and I talked just briefly before we came on the air. That's as stout a par 70 as you'll find, Dean. It's hosted the LPGA Championship, and it was awfully good to you growing up where you honed your skills, wasn't it?
We had a great time around there, and of course, the junior golf program that we had in Washington, D.C. when I grew up was the best in the country, best in the world. And I to be able to compete every week during the summer, there were so many junior tournaments, you couldn't play in them all. So I think the junior golf program in Washington, D.C. area, I know it was the best in the world. It was certainly, without that, I wouldn't have become the player that I am. I played competitive golf at an early age. I qualified for the U.S. Open twice while I was in high school. And so those junior golf programs really helped.
Wonderful gentleman named Frank Emmett ran the Washington Junior Golf Association for many, many years. Dean, this has been just a real treat. I thank you for your time and for what you've accomplished in the great game. And so happy to hear that you're still playing our great game with regularity. How many rounds of golf would we see you out playing in a particular week?
Well, I usually play two or three or four rounds a week. And I've been doing that for a number of years, but I enjoy practicing and I keep working on my game but there is a problem. And the problem is that you soon learn the older you get, the harder you have to work to keep from going behind faster.
Well, you've never been behind very much. Dean Beeman, thank you so much for your time and your insight. It was a real pleasure to have you on Musings on Golf. At William & Harry Golf, comfort meets purpose. Through their care campaign, William & Harry is partnering with charities to give back, donating a portion of every qualifying sale to support your cause. Enhance your next fundraiser with William & Harry customized golf shoes, auction packages, or exclusive giveaways. Crafted from fine deerskin, calfskin, and exotic leathers, William & Harry golf shoes offer all-day comfort from the course to the clubhouse in vibrant, eye-catching colors. Learn more at williamandharry.com or email info@williamandharry.com. William & Harry, style with a mission. I hope you enjoyed the interview with Dean Beeman. I really enjoyed talking to him because it's rare that you have someone who was a player and was so singularly focused on competing against the best players in the game. And then he made that switch to becoming a massively successful businessman and converting the PGA Tour into what had been a solid entity not long after they had split from the PGA of America into the behemoth that they are today. You need no more than watch any PGA Tour event and see what the purses, places that they play, the corporate partners, the community, and the monies that go into the charities in those communities. I'm a big fan of the PGA Tour, a big fan of Dean Beeman. I think he's done so much, and it was really cool to hear some of his comments about LIV Golf as well. Before we get to Scotty Scheffler and hearing from Scotty and Jack, I have the tip of the hat to Mason Howell, the high school junior in Georgia, one of a number of amateurs who are going to be playing at the U.S. Open next week at Oakmont Country Club. Piedmont Driving Club in Atlanta, which hosted one of the qualifiers for the U.S. Open. This kid was 18 under par over two rounds. Do you think he has any hesitation of stepping onto that first tee at Oakmont? I don't think so. I mean, he to go out and play that level of golf. And this, to me, look, we're going to talk next week with Bob Ford, the great PGA of America professional who was at Oakmont for 37 years as the head professional. And in the interview we did with Bob earlier today, he lamented a little bit that there are no PGA Club professionals that qualified for the U.S. Open. At the same time, he said, look, you've got so many great amateur players. And it's true. The depth of players, of young kids, boys and girls playing this game who are mega, uber talented is off the charts. And Mason Howell is an example. He'll you know, I'm anxious to see how he does next week at Oakmont. Okay. I keep going back when it comes to Scottie Scheffler. I keep going back to the word unflappable. You know, he just, look, guys, he doesn't beat himself in any way. He's rarely in trouble. And the times that he does miss a green, you know, he used to struggle a little bit with his putting. Not anymore. I mean, when it counted on Sunday at Memorial, no different than had been the case at the PGA Championship. And then when he won the CJ Cup, Byron Nelson, he made those 9-footers for par. He made those 4-footers for par. He just wasn't going to lose to somebody. You have to catch him. And I give, you know, Ben Griffin guy. I mean, he wins the week before and he finishes second to Scotty. He played great. And I think Ben Griffin, all signs point to this guy making the Ryder Cup team. Really, really good putter. You know, I like guys who win and guys who are pushing the likes of Scheffler, but it's hard. It's hard to beat Scottie Scheffler when he's on his game, which he clearly is. And he boy, you talk about he and Rory McIlroy kind of shaping up for a duel at Oakmont for the U.S. Open. How much fun would that be? All right, let's hear what it meant to Scottie to win and also the challenges of the rough there at Muirfield Village. Here's what Scottie had to say.
No, it was a great week. It's always special being able to come here and play Mr. Nicklaus's tournament, and the golf course was a great test this week. The rough was as healthy as I'd seen it. You know, we've had that length of rough before, but not the thickness. I mean, it was pretty nasty.
Yeah, and he doesn't knock it offline that much, but for the players in that field, the elite players in that signature event on the PGA Tour, to experience that kind of rough, I mean, they're gonna see it 5-6 inches. At Oakmont, as Bob Ford will tell you next week. Okay, so that's what Scottie had to say about the rough at Muirfield Village. How about Mr. Jack Nicklaus on the golf course that he created on the 50th anniversary of the Memorial Tournament and the rough that those youngsters had to deal with?
You know, Scottie's right about the rough. The rough was, we had a wet spring. You're going to find the same rough at Oakmont. I mean, it's the same grass, it'll be the same thing all through the whole Midwest. And, I think we were lucky to get through the week with some of the weather we had and some of the odd conditions. And but what it did is created a different condition every day. We didn't have 2 days alike. And, you know, your champion is the one who manages all those conditions. And Scottie managed him. Scottie didn't play, for him, spectacular golf. He played what he should do. He played good, solid, smart golf. And, you know, 370s and a 68, that's pretty good golf under the conditions that were out there. And, you know, that's what the best player in the world does. He comes out and does things the right way and manages it. And he sees who's on the leaderboard and who's challenging him. And you got to know who's out there. You got to know what they're doing. You got to know what you have to do. And he did. We're so proud to have Scottie not only as a champion last year, but again this year. We're very happy for him too. Obviously very happy for him.
Boy, it's hard to add a lot to what Jack had to say. And it truly was a great preparation for the players in that field who were headed on to Oakmont. I want to close with the show talking just for a second about how lucky we are to have the people in the game that we have. Jack was very emotional earlier in the week when his lovely bride, Barbara, was named the honorary figure, if you will, for the Memorial Tournament. They honor someone in golf every year. Jack was very emotional last year when he made the announcement in the booth for CBS to Jim Nance. And he was equally emotional, I thought, this week And Jack, having lived down here for, you know, in South Florida for some, gosh, coming up on 25 years, the Nicholas Children's Charities, Jack's involvement in the community in so many ways, and what he's done, he and Barbara have done in up in Ohio in many of the same ways. Barbara's the backbone, and she's the one who's really made so much of these great things possible and the legacies that they leave. And it was just a fabulous tribute to her that that she was recognized as the honoree for the Memorial Tournament this year. It's a great game with great people, and one of whom we'll hear from next week with Bob Ford. Bob Ford's legendary to me, 37 years as the head professional at Oakmont Country Club. He's the last host professional to make the cut in the U.S. Open in 1983 when he was the head professional at Oakmont. And Bob is now the official starter for the U.S. Open. Conducted a great interview with Bob earlier today, and you'll hear that next week as we prepare for the 125th playing of the U.S. Open and the Jack Nicklaus Medal and the U.S. Open Trophy to be awarded on that Sunday, Father's Day. And before they get to Oakmont, obviously, you've got the RBC Canadian Open this week with Rory McIlroy looking to win up there yet again. Terrific field as they prepare, do the final touches, the final preparations for the U.S. Open. For my good buddy, always a major champion, Bob Bupka, Kelly Elbin, thanking you for joining us and being part of Musings on Golf.